go.
Sniper arrow on the guard.
It strikes true, the guard drops.
I move to the doorway, detect traps.
None detected.
I enter.
Left flank.
Right!
One hobgoblin facing east.
Backstab.
Double damage. Critical hit, he's dead. Footsteps behind the door to the north.
I notch two arrows.
I climb the walls to get above the door.
Five goblins enter from the north.
I fire.
Both arrows hit.
Cleave!
You kill one and wound another.
I drop on the last one and grapple.
You got hold of him.
This one is for Crouton.
With his dying breath, he utters,
"The Dark Lord will kill you all."
Wait, these things can talk? I want two taken alive. I want to try something.
Welcome to Let's Roll, the show where we discuss various role-playing games with guests and fellow tabletop gamers. I'm Siskoid, and this is really part three of our look at Dungeons & Dragons' best and most interesting settings. Jonathan Schaefer-Hames is back with us this time to talk about Planescape, D&D Among the Interdimensional Planes, which first came out for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition in 1994. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Siskoid. Thanks for having me back. I'm glad to know I didn't embarrass myself too badly last time that you had me back, or at least maybe you couldn't get anyone else. I'm not sure, but...
No, but you have a deep love for this setting. You asked to be on this episode, so... And I'm on record saying it's my very favorite D&D setting. I've run it with a couple groups, never for long enough, in my opinion, and I have an almost complete collection of products. What's your history with it? You know, when did you become aware of it?
I became aware of it when it was coming out. There were a lot of really good ads for it in Dragon magazines that really made it seem like it was going to be the coolest thing. And so I bought it this day that I saw that it was out and just fell right into it. I bought every single thing that was released as it came out. It ran so many campaigns. I think I was running a campaign at the time. They all turned into Planescape campaigns at that point.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Because I was buying a lot of AD&D product back then, even if I wasn't necessarily playing it consistently. Second edition felt like the ground floor to me. I wasn't invested in the standard fantasy settings as a thing. Spelljammer had proved more fun in concept than execution. We talked about that in part two with Fred Melanson. And Planescape just blew me away and brought me back to D&D a number of times. I keep coming back to it and suggesting it. So it was doing something right. Let me just give the people a quick look at what this is. Planescape is a campaign setting designed by Zeb Cook, published in 1994. Like I said, it crosses numerous planes of existence, encompassing an entire cosmology called the Great Wheel, as developed previously in 1987's Manual of the Planes by Jeff Grubb. This includes many of the other Dungeons & Dragons worlds, obviously, linking them via interdimensional magical portals. But that's not really where the interest is. Rather, you're encouraged to start the characters in Sigil, a.k.a. the Cage, a.k.a. the City of Doors, at the very center of the Outer Planes, run by factions that express certain philosophies and worldviews, and from which all other planes of existence can be accessed. The setting is a revision of what characters from the Prime Material Plane think is reality, and is entirely survivable to first-level characters. Well, I say entirely. You know, you can play Planescape without it, you being, you know, super levels. The Planescape campaign setting box set would go on to win the 1994 Origins Award for best graphic presentation of a role-playing game, adventure, or supplement, and has received critical acclaim for its unique visual aspects, especially the works of artists Tony D. Terlizzi, Rob Ruppel, and Dana Knutson. It spawned a large number of gorgeous accessories, box sets, adventures, an atmospheric CD, a video game, Planescape Torment, a collectible card game, Blood Wars, and six novels. And when Wizards of the Coast bought TSR, well, of course, they discontinued Planescape. We'll talk about the future of the setting towards the end of the show. But I think we can maybe start our conversation with Sigil, the City of Doors. As mentioned in our previous AD&D setting episode, one of Spelljammer's mistakes, I felt, was that it expected you to start from a regular world, and it didn't have a starter location. You essentially had to level up to get there. In Planescape, you start play already a member of a community in a city built inside a floating donut at the center of reality. Even at first level, you're wiser than those clueless Burks fiddling about in the Forgotten Realms or Greyhawk. You know the truth with a capital T, right? So, Sigil, was that part of your love for this setting?
Oh, a wee bit, yes. And I would be remiss because I imagine half of your audience that is familiar with Planescape is screaming at their listening devices that it's pronounced Sigil. And the other half
is it?
The other half doesn't care. So they at the beginning of it, in the first box set, they made a big thing a couple of times that it had a hard G, that that's how they pronounce it.
I will never say it that way.
Yeah,
never.
No, absolutely not. but that was the whole thing. So that if that was one of the ways you would know a Clueless is if they tried to call it Sigil. But that kind of went away once they got away from the box set. And I've never called it Sigil because the one time I tried, my entire play group just looked at me weird and I felt really uncomfortable. So it was Sigil after that.
Well, Sigil is a word that means something already. Mm-hmm. It evokes that magical feel. And G before an I is a soft G. I'm sorry. There's just rules.
I agree with you there. And man, so it's like Sigil, Sigil. It's like, what if a bunch of first-year philosophy students decided to all come live together in a donut and then try to kill each other?
Right. Philosophers with clubs is the way the game describes it. Yeah, I mean, having a city at the center of this where you can adventure inside the city. You don't have to move to other planes to have an interesting time with Planescape. I think that city alone has a lot of weirdness in it, has all these factions that you can interact with, interesting in and of itself.
Exactly. It's the best place to introduce the whole concept of what a Planescape campaign is going to be around. It's like Waterdeep on steroids in that first of all, the city's weird. It's like I said, you're on the inside of a donut that is on the top of an infinitely tall spire in the middle of an infinitely wide plane. You know, and you can just keep walking and walking until you will eventually come back where you were. And if you look up, you see the rest of the city above you. And there's like every kind of creature or person from every place popping in and out in front of you. It's just, I mean, just the adventure hooks that just create themselves out of the setting itself are just incredible.
Right. And the city is nominally ruled by the Lady of Pain, who is the figure that is in the middle of the logo.
Right.
I'll put some images up on our image gallery at fireandwaterpodcast.com. So the Lady of Pain is, I don't know if you believe this, but apparently she was maybe designed after the CEO of TSR back in the day, Lorraine Williams, who was not necessarily appreciated by a lot of people, unapproachable, like the employees didn't feel that she was one of them in a way. So I don't know if the Lady of Pain is supposed to be Lorraine Williams, but it's an amusing notion that this got through if it is.
Yeah, I've heard this, but I've never heard anyone directly connected with Planescape or TSR say it. It's always okay. Somebody who knows. And it sounds like the kind of thing that just people would have caught on, especially during the years that Gary Gygax was really trying to drag Lorraine's name through the mud.
Yeah, so it's an urban legend.
Exactly. I kind of like it, though.
It's funny. The factions, I think, are the most important part of this, really, because in the city, they each run an essential part, or most of them do anyways. You know, they're the armory, or the market, or the temples, or the mortuary. And they take their particular philosophy of life to extremes. I love that in the plains, the more people think a certain way, the more that becomes the truth.
I know.
It's where there's conflict between the planes themselves, since they represent alignments. So the more chaotic good in the universe, the more chaotic good it is in general, is what they're proposing. And then the factions are in conflict because they want their version of reality, which is not alignment-based, to similarly rule. I thought this was like a brilliant way to envision the universe.
It's so great. And I mean, just the factions themselves and just kind of what they imply and just the level of woolly thinking you can really get into about it, you know, because essentially what we got here, this is a libertarian paradise is Sigil. And it both shows the pros and cons of such a thing. It's a city without an actual ruler. The Lady of Pain is the stand-in for whatever supernatural or high-tech thing has to keep the libertarian paradise going to make sure that things go. But it's the whole idea of, in the absence of actual laws, there become rules. And the rules are enforced just by whoever says, you know, it's a might makes right sort of thing. So, but the other thing is, in the absence of actual structure, they wind up creating versions of what the structure would have been in the first place. They don't have courts, but they have the Doom Guard. You know, they don't have the police. They have the Harmonium, all of that stuff. And it's all while they're all fighting about who's right, they're all doing their part to make the city work. There's just so much packed in there.
Yeah, they can't take over anybody else's place because then the Lady of Pain is going to come in and slap him on the wrist, by which I mean throw them into a interdimensional maze from which they will never escape. So, I mean, also, when she looks at someone, they're just like slashes of knives appear on their bodies. You know, she's dangerous.
Yeah, and she won't let you worship her. If you try to worship her, that's where she will be most likely to take an active role to stop you, which was always such a wonderful mystery.
I like that we never find out what she's all about. Yeah, because one of the things I really dug, and this is where the factions really come in as far as mechanics, is that in AD&D second edition, there were overlays you could put on your standard character classes. So all fighters weren't necessarily the same because you could add a what they called a kit, a beast rider, a gladiator, you know. And in Planescape, there was an extra layer of faction, which also gave you special restrictions and abilities. So for example, the Aethar, they don't believe the gods who live in the outer planes are gods at all. So they're immune to certain clerical spells, but that includes healing. Their opposite number, the Believers of the Source, they believe everything and everyone has the divine spark and that anyone could evolve into gods themselves someday. So they have better reactions from others and they reincarnate automatically when they die. So these are just some examples. The factions, from what I've read, are kind of based on, well, the hot game at the time was Vampire the Masquerade.
Right.
And you were part of a clan, etc. So what White Wolf was doing, D&D started emulating by saying, oh, well, you know, if there's factions, they're just like clans, and each of these clans has specific philosophies, ways of working, dynamics between them. And that's what they wanted to do with Planescape.
Yeah, and that's, I was going to say the exact same thing. I mean, White Wolf's Vampire especially was the most popular game going at this time. And TSR was throwing out a lot of products, but this was one that was really looking at that and looking at things about it that made it popular. And the factions were a new thing. It was finally just the idea that your character wasn't necessarily, didn't have the abilities they have because of who they were, but it was who they were with.
Or how they thought.
Or how they thought, exactly.
What they believed,
and,
yeah.
And all the people that they were around. And it really, it changed the way we were able to think about D&D campaigns, but in that and a number of other things. But that was really the first thing, just the idea that external organizations that you could then join within the game that would then give you bonuses within the game was very appealing.
I always liked it better than alignments as a role-playing element because I always felt like the alignments were rather abstract and hard to put into motion or sometimes abused. But philosophies, and people could interpret their philosophy in many different ways, right? You could justify many things using the faction's philosophy. This was easier to turn into role-playing where people would discuss and debate and what do we do, but well, what we should do based on my belief rather than based on where I align myself with order and chaos and good and evil. You know, I always thought this was like a much better hook. Do you have a favorite faction?
You know, when I played, I usually was just the Free League. Because that was the easier.
Free of it.
Well, yeah, because I'm not sure when I was playing or running it that I really quite grokked, you know, what all the factions were about. I was probably in my 20s. But I really like the Believers of the Source. I also like the Dustmen a great deal.
Oh, yeah. The Dustmen. Because they think we're all dead already.
Already. And then eventually we'll die again. And then we'll reach true death when we'll remember all of the forgotten deaths. Which is tied into a lot of, you know, real world belief systems, as these all were, which is
right. Even the extreme ones. I mean, I liked the Sign of One because I, at the time, I was like in 94, I was getting out of university, but you know, I was an English major, and one of the authors that I most studied was William Blake.
Ah, there you go.
And his philosophy was you create the world as you experience it, seeing it creates it. So that's what the Sign of One were all about. You know, maybe you're a figment of my imagination is the insulting way to do it. But I like them. I like the Transcendent Order, who are basically, you know, they're Zen archers, essentially. You know, they let the universe move through them and they just surrender to the moment. And I got to say, this is part of my own philosophy in terms of, you know, I'm not a philosopher of the club, but I'm a philosopher who plays improv, teaches improv. And one of my big improv things that I teach people is the Zen action, how to just let the improvisation move through you rather than try to force it into whatever shape. So I am a Zen master at my particular skill. So I like the Transcendent Order because of that.
They're pretty great. I liked the Doomguard as they originally were sort of portrayed, more so than how they became just, you know, the default corrupt bad guys you needed to deal with in town in most adventures. But at first, they were kind of supposed to be like Nietzsche-style nihilists, you know, in terms of we're all doomed, so let's work within that.
Yeah, let's help the universe achieve entropy.
Yeah.
Was their thing, yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily, I mean, yeah, that's, of course, there's going to be people that think of that as negative, but that particular philosophy isn't a negative one in and of itself.
No, none of them were, right? So I never used them as villains, but there are a couple of factions that seem more villainous than others. The Mercy Killer.
Yeah, we bet.
That's, you know, so, I mean, they look villainous. Harmonium, you know, they don't look... It feels like that would be hard to have any party, you know, if someone were taking it to the natural extremes. That's a question. Is there party balance between the philosophies? For example, you know, like in a normal D&D game, I personally would not allow evil characters in a party of good characters.
Right.
I'm not interested in that kind of stuff. They're always backstabbing and stealing from people. It just doesn't work for me as what is this group of friends? So... Same thing with factions. Some are definitely more villainous, power hungry, or selfish, but does that preclude them from working together, in your opinion? Like, do you have any memories from your own games where this was a problem or that where this was addressed?
I don't think that kind of thing really didn't come up in our games as much. I think as the game is designed, Sigil itself is an example of how they can work together in a party because they are there working together in a city. As long as you can give them all an external thing to want to do, you know, that should be enough to keep them cohesive. It's going to be like anything. If you've got a good group of people, you know, it'll just turn into fun role-playing opportunities rather than fun campaign-destroying opportunities. So.
And there's also the, like, well, you like to play the non-faction, which is the Free League, but there is another non-faction, which is the Clueless, the Outsiders.
Ah, yes.
So you could bring in a character from the Prime Material Plane, from Greyhawk, from Kryn, from Toril, but those characters would be called the Clueless. They'd be the Hicks, the bumpkins who show up there and have their own preconceptions of what this is supposed to be. And for them, it's probably like the Outer Planes are the afterlife and, you know, there's something, the hells and the heavens, and all those names are changed. If you're a planner character, you know, you're not calling this place hell and that place heaven. That's ridiculous because they're actual places for you, you know.
I know.
But yeah, you could also play a clue. I think that I never had a Clueless in my parties when I tried to play this because the groups are too small, but I wish there'd been like, you know, this one idiot.
One of the campaigns we did was an entire group of people that got sucked out of the War of the Lance on Kryn and just got deposited, you know, had to work through hell and then to Sigil. So they had to work. It was, we did one of the Well of the Worlds thing, but that turned into a whole campaign. So they had to actually meet with and encounter factions, and a couple of them joined factions and some of them didn't.
That's interesting. One of the things we haven't been talking about or doing, maybe thankfully, is the cant. Like, there is a specific way of speaking in Planescape, like a lot of words, expressions based on old slang, Victorian, Elizabethan. I've recognized these words from older literature. Very tough for a non-English speaking group, I gotta say.
Oh,
so
my God.
For me, yeah, some words you can use pretty easily. I think Burke or Jink or, you know, there's like these small words can be used in a sort of Franglish kind of way, but definitely not all, not in French. So we either ignored it or we found old French slang to make up for it. I don't know if it did much because we speak Acadian French, which is already replete with archaic words on account of when our ancestors came to America. So mileage may vary.
We didn't use it. At all.
At all.
Maybe occasionally when we, you know, we use it at first, like when the campaign started and they showed up, I would have a people just lay it on thick to show that they were in a different place and make it all confusing. But mostly it was just at the time we all found it silly and embarrassing. Now, if I do it, I use it all the time.
Okay. Because I was kind of afraid that you would lay it on thick here now.
No, my wife told me not to. She said that only an addle-coved Burke would be rattling their bone box off on that without promise of a lot of jink.
Thanks, Maggie. I felt like we needed to use something just to make it, I don't know, give it that flavor. But yeah, because of the translation issues, it wasn't quite. People at home, if you play Planescape, let us know. You know, how thick was your accent? Like I said, you can spend a lot of time in Sigil because there's lots to do in fighting politics. Just treat it as a Waterdeep or a City of Greyhawk, obviously. But there are also all those other planes you can go to, right? The astral, the ethereal, the inner planes, which people call the elemental planes, the old prime material, of course, and then the outer planes. Very strange worlds built on mechanical gears or just floating in a soup of chaos. Places that used to be called Twin Paradises or Nine Hells, but Planner characters know them under different names, less superstitious names. I guess one question we can ask is what we think of, you know, in this, demons are now called Tanari, and devils from Betor are now Batezu. Angels are called Archons, you know, so they kind of remove that religious satanic panic stuff.
Right. That was a deliberate effort. I mean, and as a carryover, there was an earlier product. I mean, they had the Monstrous Compendium Outer Planes appendix, and that's where they kind of set up the whole, you know, meta version of it, and they gave them the names. And it was clear at the time, I remember seeing them, I think I was a senior in high school or whatever, knowing full well that it was doing it to appease to religious people or to attempt to avoid the sales loss or whatever. But still, at the same time, they really came up with cool alternate names. I mean, and in some of the cases, the earlier names were really dumb of the planes, like the Happy Hunting Grounds versus the Beastlands, for example.
Right.
I know which one I want to go and adventure in.
And one of these is culturally insensitive, you know, so it's a good reason to change it. Yeah, they changed a lot of these names. And to me, it felt justified because they tell us up front, the planner characters in Sigil, they think we're stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
We've put a religion around the Outer Planes, which is just their home. You know, so what we think of as the afterlife and mysterious and religious, that's just their common day-to-day. So, you know, we're not going to be calling these places those names. And we're not going to be calling people devils or demons because, I mean, they're sitting right there in the restaurant next to us, you know?
That guy's Gus. He owes me $5, you know.
You can't start treating people as angels or demons. You know them as their actual species. So the fact that there is a truth that is hidden from the prime material, that these people are wiser for, you know, to know all these things, to be common every day for them, justified changing all the names, removing the sort of Christian aspects to it.
I agree. You know, and plus it just gave them enough of a buffer thing so that they could eventually, once they felt they needed to, bring back to calling them demons and devils again. But, I mean, Tanari is a really cool name, you know, with an unnecessary apostrophe in it for an evil race of beings that want to destroy the multiverse. I mean, I'm going to be just as scared of them because they do the same amount of damage. So it's,
yeah, they're the same. I mean, they still live in the abyss, which is, now it's an infinite. I think it's infinite.
Infinite.
Yeah, it used to be like 666.
Yep, they probably took layers. That out for the same reason.
I mean, one of the things about Sigil, we called it the City of Doors because it's kind of peppered with portals. Some of them permanent, some of them temporary or shifting. And one of the treasure things that, I mean, one of the ways to control this, if you're a game master, is that these portals need keys. Sometimes it's an object, sometimes it's a word or a gesture, and sometimes you can make the characters, one of the things I love to do, but not all the time, but I mean, you know, this is probably a trick I used, they accidentally have the key and then turn the corner and boom, they're somewhere they don't want to be.
Oh yeah, give them the wrong change at the bar and suddenly they have a coin that walking throughout the door they came in suddenly takes them off to the abyss.
But Sigil is a great way to get to anywhere, but also you can withhold, you know, if they want to go someplace specific, well, they'll need to adventure to just get that information/treasure. So there's the adventure before the adventure sort of thing. And you can really control where you're going to go because otherwise it's an infinite place with infinite access. It can be very hard for a game master who wants to let his players do things, go where they want to. But, you know, how do you prepare for all of these different places if you don't have kind of a control method? Well, I mean, a lot of these environments in the Outer Planes are crazy, and so they always lead to interesting just survival situations. But they also mess with magic. And this is one of my, especially looking back on it, this is one of the things that I don't like so much. You know, spells are affected. Different planes, obviously, you can't cast a fireball in the water plane. And I mean, that's basic. But even so, even every plane has a sort of effect on magic that can lower it, heighten it, kill it entirely, modify it, which is kind of complicated for the GM, to really figure out all the, you know, have that on, at the tip of your fingers. But worse, I think, is that the distance between your location and your god's residence drains your priest's levels or spell power.
Yeah, and then there was the thing on the Outlands where the closer you got to the spire, you know, you'd lose access to some of your spells. We solved all of that by ignoring the hell out of it.
Good job. I mean, the book, you know, talks about power keys and that you could, or spell keys, or you could use these things. And again, you might adventure to get access to something that will allow you to have free flowing access to your abilities. But I had the same problem with Spelljammer. It's like when you're moving around and, oh, well, you're in another crystal sphere, so you lose contact with your gods. I mean, it's not like magic users and priests have much going for them if you remove their spells. Like, why would you nerf these characters who, for whom it is quite hard to level up?
There seemed to be a lot of stuff in first edition especially, but it bled into second edition.
Yeah.
Where it was really trying to be about quote-unquote realism or balancing things out. And without really asking the very important question of, would you want to play a character that this was happening to? And because it's stupid. I mean, who wants to play a character, you know, a cleric, roll it all up and stuff, and then, oh, yeah, sorry, your god doesn't work. I don't know. You'll have to figure out how that make it work again. In the meantime, use the crappy cleric tables and hit him with your mace.
Yeah, I agree that it came from first edition had a lot of these things, and then Planescape is an adaptation of what they did with the Manual of the Planes, with every product that ever went to the planes, where it was always a killer environment.
Right.
You know, but it's the same thing with first edition started the ball, and that kept going where, oh, you're playing an elf or a dwarf. Well, you can only reach such and such a level. And why is this important?
But I think a lot of second edition was really Planescape, rather, aspects of it were really starting to widen the cracks that had been there for a long time to show how D&D needed an overhaul, because it really wasn't capable of properly telling the kinds of stories that people wanted their games to tell. And they would either have to make huge changes in the way the game worked, like this, or even more so in Dark Sun, or just kind of creating a world that a vibe you were supposed to be going for that you really couldn't quite achieve. Like, again, Dark Sun was a problem. Dark Sun was a great setting, but wasn't good for second edition rules. We can talk about that when I beg you to be on the Dark Sun one.
Okay.
No, I already called Dragonlance. You can give Dark Sun to somebody else. So.
Always set up the next one. Do you have any favorite planes that you guys might have gone to?
Oh, several. Well, the Abyss is so great because it's an infinite amount of planes within an infinite plane. But it's like the first level of it is like they call it the plane of infinite doors or infinite closets. And it's just the entire plane is just full of holes, and all of them are portals to everywhere else, supposedly. But actually, they're just to other places in the Abyss. And it's like the way it's written up half the time, there's no map to the Abyss. It's all chaotic and it all changes. So you just have to basically jump into a hole and see where it takes you. On the other end of it, Mechanus and the Modrons especially is like one of the greatest things that Planescape was able to do. They were able to take something that was just basically ignored and or looked at as a joke in the first edition Modrons and turn them into some of the most interesting things that D&D's ever produced. It's just a great time. You can have some great adventures there.
Yeah, this is the plane of pure order. It's the one that's clockworks. Mm-hmm. And then the Modrons are a hierarchy of, I don't want to call them the robots, but they are sort of mechanical looking. And so the Modrons are just like these balls with legs and an eye. Above them, you get characters with more sides, polyhedrals.
Somebody was looking at their dice while they were up against a deadline.
Yeah, and there's one product called the Great Modron March that sort of sets up a campaign where there's something brewing, and the Modrons sort of periodically, they just walk the great wheel, go through the world, and we don't know what they're doing and why they're doing it. And so the Great Modron March is sort of this thing you can set up that in the early levels, you kind of hear about it or you touch upon it. And eventually you're always crossing paths with these guys as you go through your life. You know, I don't know how long that would take, you know, to level up to the last adventure of that thing. But it was something that I myself had set up, you know, probably played the first one and always kept the Great Modron March in the news.
Yeah, I ran that adventure and I ran Dead Gods as a sequel. It took us probably 3 years. And this was back in those great glorious days where we could meet, you know, twice a week and play for, you know, 12 hours at a time because who needs sleep?
And it still took you 3 years.
Oh, yeah. It was, well, you were alluding to it. The best part about them both is that they're not and this event segues into this. These are just things that are expected for you to just put into your regular campaigns that you're running. And I did the same thing as you did. I had the Modron March was in the news, and every now and then they'd be on a completely unrelated mission and suddenly Modrons, and they would be like, oh yeah, and then it builds up and then you find out what's causing it, and then they become completely proactive. Dead Gods is really, it's an amazing adventure, because one of the huge strengths of Planescape is, as we were talking about, it gave a place for low level characters, you know, to be in a high level realm. And that was kind of great because it kind of corrals the players a little bit, because they're terrified and think that everything's going to kill them. But then once they actually are able to get to a high level through anything, then the multiverse is theirs. And they can just run all over the place. And that campaign made me into the dungeon master I am today, because I had to roll with every punch I could think of, because you can only curtail them so long when they have the spell gate.
Right. Yeah. Eventually they can just move around. It's a little bit like they've got the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And you're racing to catch up. I like Mechanist too. Like, that was an outlier in the sense that, because it was tied to the Modron March, etc., and I thought it was really fascinating. Mm-hmm. That was a plane of order that I liked. But the first box set, the Planner box set, was the Planes of Chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And that one I read cover to cover. I can't claim the same of the other box sets when they came out, because, like I said, I only played sporadically. But that first box, Planes of Chaos.
That was a great box set. Planes of Law and Conflict were also great, but Chaos was my favorite.
I think it was structured a little different as well. I gotta say, brilliant to split them up, Chaos, Order, not a box of good and evil, you know?
I liked that a lot too, especially with what you were talking about, alignment. That's an aspect of alignment, you know, that it gets tossed aside lately. Originally, it was all just law and chaos. It was meant to evoke like Elric and other books of that nature. But splitting it up in planes of law and neutrality and chaos, it allows you to really, for the first time, kind of see what chaotic good and chaotic evil have in common.
Yeah, that's interesting on that basis. But also, it meant that each box had some good planes and evil planes and neutral planes. So a good mix, whereas maybe you'd think, no, I just want the evil box because I want to go adventure. You know, I want my heroes to go up against these big bads. And then you don't think there's something interesting about Isgard or, you know. So I liked Isgard and Limbo and the Abyss, because they're all in there, that first box. So they tend to be my favorites.
Limbo's great. Pandemonium. Bytopia, the Twin Paradises.
Right.
I remember that one just being a really interesting heaven. And they had its own little thing going on with the people living on one paradise and the other one, and you could set up all sorts of... There were just so many campaign hooks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is such a huge world that you'll never visit everything. You know, it'll take you forever to explore every nook and cranny and every little bit that was interesting, in the way that all of D&D's best settings are like this. You know, like Forgotten Realms was like this. Mm-hmm. Very evocative, a lot of adventure hooks that if you just let your imagination run and not buy any other products, you know, out of the first box, you had it all.
And this one for me was, even though I did buy all of the other things, I really wouldn't have needed to. That first box set had so much imagination inspiring stuff in it.
So we mentioned factions. One of the things we didn't mention is playable character races.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because obviously humans are in it. Although we're told planar humans are slightly different from primordial ones. You can also play half elf, because your half is a planar human.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to play a prime race like elf or dwarf or halfling, you're going to have to come from the primordial. Instead, they've been replaced by three different ones. The Barrior, who are goat-like centaurs. The Gitzerai? I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Me neither. The Githyanki is the other one, right? Or that's
yeah, right. They're opponents.
Right.
But the Gitzerai are near humans from Limbo who have innate magical resistance. And tieflings, who have a strain of demonic blood. This was one of my house rules, was that if you had a tiefling, you didn't have necessarily the cast darkness that they get once per day. Mm-hmm. I asked them what they wanted their mutation to be, like their trait, like what is it? Is it like a spiky tail, or is it a weird lump, or just a smell of brimstone?
Yeah.
And then based on the description they gave me, I went and looked at the various demonic races. And then, okay, yeah, probably has an ancestor that was whatever, a type 1 demon, as we used to call them, which is not very evocative of anything.
You know, that's kind of funny because tieflings have stayed in D&D. This is where they were created, but they're a playable race now. They're very different in both looks and origin, except now with the coming of the new 1D&D. They have already revealed what, or at least in the playtest version of the tieflings, and they give you the option. There's one of two kinds of tieflings. You can either be the tiefling that has been for the past few years in 5th edition, or you can have one that's basically a planescape tiefling. They look like that, and they have much more of a more mysterious origin rather than definitely a diabolical one.
Because the way I played them, like, instead of cast darkness, you got an ability that was connected to the...
Sure. Which is
to
great.
The demon that we picked, right? I've seen that tieflings were incorporated into D&D now. Mm-hmm. I had the feeling that people thought they were sort of these insufferable ninjas, by which I mean back in the early days.
Oh, that's very true.
You know, people always wanted to play ninjas or what? Space elves is another term that I've used or heard. You know, these characters that have all the mystery and all the abilities, and they're so cool, and they're too cool for the group. The rest of the group is all like, ugh, grown. Is that what tieflings have become?
That hasn't been my experience. So I think most of the people have either fond memories of them from Planescape or just have grown up with them just existing in 5th edition. So don't like them more or less than the other ones.
Yeah, they sort of replaced the half-orc.
Yeah.
You don't see that a lot anymore. I don't know. But yeah, they're just sort of similar where a parent or a grandparent was from an evil race. It's kind of the idea. Mm-hmm. And like my group had, or my last group, because like I said, I tried it a couple of times. My last group had a tiefling and a barrior, but nobody wants to play the Gitzerai because they can't pronounce the name.
And they weren't as cool as the Githyanki were anyway. So
exactly. So yeah, the Githyanki have a cooler look.
And they ride red dragons and live in the freaking, the astral plane worshiping a lich queen. That sounds more interesting than Limbo monks.
But obviously they're supposed to be villains, I suppose, with that description. And the Gitzerai are, I don't know, nobody ever wanted to play that. So, but the other ones, yes.
There were also some other races that eventually got added to it, including my personal favorite, the Rogue Modron.
Oh, yeah.
Which was the Modron who somehow developed sentience, or just developed a sense of his own individuality, which no other Modrons possess except for Primus, but that's a whole other thing. And so it's great. You have to not only try to figure out how to think as an individual for the first time in a millennia-long existence, but also every other Modron that sees you will try to kill you just because you are an abomination to the universe as far as they're concerned.
So you had that in your campaign, or you played it yourself?
We had one in the campaign I was running. It was an NPC, and he became the basic party mascot, and they threw so much, wasted so many healing items on that guy. They did not want him to die. And I was like, it was the greatest player resource drain I have ever created was Max of the Modron. But he was great. He was fun to just be strange and weird and just weird and ask all sorts of robot toddler questions, basically.
I was looking my notes earlier. As I like a folder that is all Planescape, that particular campaign. And I was surprised. I guess it lasted longer than I remember. I don't know. It was a failed experiment in the sense that the players weren't really wanting to do fantasy. And I'd convinced them, neither do I, but this is different. But then, I don't know, we sort of migrated to something else, or perhaps players dropped out or life reasons. I don't remember why we ended it, but I thought we ended it earlier than we did. Because we played a lot of adventures, according to my notes.
Oh, well, that's good.
And a lot of them were right out of the plot hooks from Planes of Chaos or some of the early anthology things. Like, you know, there's one, there's a love letter. You got to deliver a love letter between, what is it?
It's
like a demon and a devil.
Yeah, it's a Romeo and Juliet sort of between the demon and devil, or Tenari and Beatitu, or we did that one too.
Yeah, there's a lot of different setups for adventures that I felt like this works really well. It's like all the adventures aren't the same. It's not all you're in an inn and somebody approaches you, you know, because of the factions as well, right? Factions can send you on missions. You can just fall into a hole randomly. There was a lot of variety. And I know that I used, I'm going to talk about this in the advice column after our conversation, but there is a fan-made newsletter supposed to be the newspaper Sigis.
Oh, I've seen that. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's on Mimir.net, which is was a big resource. The website still exists. It's pretty old school, but it still exists, and all those newspapers are there. And so I would pick those newspapers, I modify them, put maybe articles that had to do with adventures that were coming up or stuff like that. But I used it as sort of a background. And sometimes if the characters got interested in something, okay, well, that may be an adventure later, you know. What I really wanted to do was build on the idea of the city and make it as vibrant and as real as possible, because you're always coming back to it, you know.
And it really gave you so many tools to do that. I mean, the factions themselves were just tools to do that, but so many colorful NPCs. And just which would just spark your imagination to create your own, because you could have anything from the Monster Manual be there.
Sure.
It didn't have to be evil, or maybe it was, but it wasn't something that you could kill because you wanted to buy something from it. Like, it's a giant bear. He's selling you a +4 sword. Go.
Yeah, it was meant to be weird. And I was a fan at the time, obviously, 94. Jesus. I was reading Vertigo Comics. I was deep into Grant Morrison's work. I was at university. I fell into a deep vortex of Dadaism and...
Well, they saw you coming then.
Borges. And so much of the... I think some of the inspirations for Planescape, just in the zeitgeist, I guess. You know, I was also reading up on those things, looking at those things, the weirdness factor very much interested me. Other games like Over the Edge was also a weird city. And I know my players wanted to start something there, but, you know, it didn't go further than character generation. There was something in the air, you know, basically, as far as I was concerned. And I was breathing it all in. But ultimately, I guess the question for people out there, obviously, if you're going to play Planescape today, you're going to just, you know, buy some PDFs, which is still available, or find the product somewhere, you know, and they're gorgeous products. You got, you know, these box sets, these maps, and very good looking.
They're incredible. Probably, in my opinion, the best products that TSR's era put out, those box sets. They were like Christmas morning, opening one of those things.
Really beautiful, great art, evocative, distinctive. None of, of their other products look like this. But still, the question is, why this rather than Garden Variety D&D? Because I think most players, they kind of gravitate towards the more normal sword and sorcery. But why would someone pick Planescape over Forgotten Realms, for example, or Greyhawk, or the more standard settings?
Well, I mean, we talked when I was on for Forgotten Realms about how Forgotten Realms was striving to really set itself out from Greyhawk and Kryn, that it had its own aspects that really made it feel different. Planescape feels different from anything else that you will ever play in a D&D world, and can kind of elevate how you will play D&D from now on. At least it did for me. It felt, when I first encountered it, and it, part of that might have been that I was, you know, 22 years old or whatever, but it really felt like it was D&D for grownups, much more so than the stuff did before. The stuff did before just kind of felt like it was definitely its own thing. This felt like it was trying to say something. I'm not sure if it quite got to say what it did, but no other campaign setting has captured my imagination and set it off in other worlds, and just immediately, from the second you look at the box cover, your brain is already going, and it will get you thinking about itself and D&D in ways that you have not before.
Every time I open these books, I'm always like, oh, I got to play this. But unfortunately, I'm in some other game that I'm deeply invested in.
Yeah, like right now.
Yeah, like right now. We're in Torg Eternity and we're in it to win it. You know, it's I got a group going. This is going to go for years. I truly believe that based on the personalities and the people and the setup and how much we've invested in it financially. And Torg is not unlike this, a clash of different dimensions, and it can be very weird.
Probability Wars.
The Possibility.
Possibility Wars, sorry.
So we're playing that, and obviously the show, well, on the show, we'll discuss Torg Eternity in due course once we've played it a little bit more. But Planescape, I'm always like, I'm ready to swallow the fact that maybe AD&D second editions can be a little bit clunky. We talked a bit about that last time as well, right? These rules are kind of dated and just the D&D rules are not necessarily my favorite. So I don't know if I would want to adapt it in some way.
Well, good news. At the end of, I think, within a year from now, D&D 5th edition is putting out a Planescape box set.
Is that confirmed?
That is confirmed.
All right. If we just look at the future, well, beyond 2nd edition, 3rd edition did keep many of the details of Planescape, including Sigil, as part of the overall cosmology of D&D, but they didn't explore it as a setting. Like 3rd, and indeed like 1st, 4th edition had a manual of the planes. And this one restructured the mythology, but kept Sigil in place.
Right.
Dungeon Master's Guide 2 treats the city as a Paragon-level setting and contains Conspiracy of Doors, which was the first Sigil adventure in years. But no factions, because...
Faction war.
Yeah, well, the faction war, which is something that I'd rather ignore completely. But towards the end of the setting there, the story arc of Sigil is that the factions get into a war and maybe they're eliminated or something. I don't love that, but I didn't dig into it much more than this. And so 5th edition, the Player's Handbook and the Dungeon Master's Guide contain sections explaining the planes, and they briefly mention Sigil there. So we had hints early on, and then July of this year, Unearthed Arcana, Wonders of the Multiverse was released, and that hinted at the possibility of relaunching the Planescape setting, but you're telling me they are doing it.
They are definitely doing it. The 1D&D playtest material that's out right now mentions Sigil in the humans section and implies that Sigil may have been the original birthplace for humans in the multiverse.
Wow.
So I'm curious to see where that goes.
It's interesting. It's definitely interesting. And then, of course, well, we always do a sort of product recommendation. While you wait, and maybe when they relaunch Planescape, not all the information will be... I mean... There are so many adventures and box sets from the previous iteration that you might want to look into to supplement your 5th edition Planescape stuff, or just, you know, start now, no waiting. So are there products you'd like to recommend, box sets, source books, adventures?
Oh, geez. Well,
it's all good. Obviously.
It's all good. It really is. You could, if you get a good price on any of them, pick it up. You will not regret it if you're into any, if any of the stuff we've talked about sounds interesting. Besides what we've already talked about, the Planes of series is pretty almost vital to a full understanding of it. The Modron March and Dead Gods duology of adventures is a great structure to build a campaign around. What else was there? You know, Tales of the Infinite Staircase. It was one of the best adventure collections, I think, that TSR did in any world. It gives a great sort of premise. It's a nice sort of drop in and out adventure sort of thing, and a great way to kind of wet your feet.
Yeah, I think they did a good work with all those anthologies. Yes, you can buy an adventure and it's like longer form, but you get a lot of value out of those anthologies because there are many adventures that you might be able to use at different levels. Doors to the Unknown, Well of Worlds, or others, you know. And so you get a lot of adventures that don't all follow the same formula either. So I think it was interesting. In terms of early adventures that you can play early levels, I've used the Eternal Boundary a couple times. Each of the groups had to go through the Eternal Boundary. It's about smuggling of dead bodies out of the mortuary and into other planes. A good detective infiltration adventure, and you get to meet a couple different factions in there. So I thought that was a great introductory adventure to Sigil.
That is a good one. I liked, what is that one? Oh, Fires of Dis we had fun with.
It's one of the early ones, Into the Abyss is another one, the Diva Spark, they're pretty early. They all look great. Even if I have not played them, I'm ready to vouch for them. In terms of source books, especially as the characters level up, I'd recommend the Fractals Manifesto.
Oh, yes. That was the one. Plus, and In the Cage, A Fractal's Guide to Sigil are both great.
Full of
amazing NPCs.
I think NPCs, when you have a setting where you keep returning to that, the town that you keep returning to, you need those NPCs because they become, you know, the contacts and rivals, and they make the setting come alive. You know, there's a recognizability factor there. And the Fractals Manifesto, I really use because it gives you possible upgrades for faction members. So as they get, you know, more involved in their own faction, and it describes all their headquarters, and there are a lot of adventure hooks for the city itself. Also, what does it mean to really, really believe, you know, level up in your belief, and you can gain more abilities. And so, yeah, I'd recommend that one. And the one I'd be careful with is the Faction War, because it clearly happens much later. It dismantles the setting. So it's your finisher.
The problem was that was actually part two of what was supposed to be three. There was supposed to be a follow-up to it that was going to reconcile it. It went Dyvek Nadai and into what a third one was. Never got to make it.
We would have had a restructured Sigil at the end.
Exactly. It was going to restructure it with the idea of going forward into third edition. But which,
and that never happened.
It never happened. So everybody's stuck with the memory of everything being lame at the end.
Yeah. A lot of games did this at some point. It jumped a shark kind of. You know, when they crashed the computer in paranoia or whatever.
Right. Or the apocalypse finally happening, or the masquerade.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, it's like an end game, which is interesting, but wouldn't you rather your players play forever? So, okay, final section that we always do is lessons. What did we learn from Planescape? And you played with it a lot. I'm impressed and jealous. Frankly,
we were lucky. I didn't want to have this group of people. What I learned from Planescape, I learned that there was more you could do with D&D, or even with more you can do with role-playing games, that you can just expand what it is. And plus, it was also really good at teaching me into being a D&D, a dungeon master who cared about social encounters as well, because there was a lot less fighty-fighty in that one, because you can't fight against everything you see, so people had to be good at doing things in other ways. I think I've gushed a lot about this, and you guys listening might think that I like it, and, well, you're right.
You do, yeah, yeah. I think, well, the most important thing I probably learned from Planescape at the time, and I'm saying that because it carried into all my other games, is the value of a home base.
Yeah.
Because when you start off D&D, like when I was a teenager, and I'm calling it D&D, but it was sort of more of a homebrew, because we didn't have all the books. So it was D&D, but not the rules, mm-hmm. not any given setting, whatever. But you tend to be very nomadic. You're walking around, you're going, oh, there's a dungeon there, let's go down that dungeon. You're, you know.
Murder hobo, I believe, is the term.
Is that what? That's kind of your training ground, right? So when you get older, you can stick with that reflex, or you can look at other things, and now they're being done. The fact that Sigil was such an interesting place that you could go off on an adventure from there and then return, like in a normal town, in a normal D&D setting, if you go out, you know, a day's walk in any direction, there's just so much that can happen there. Whereas in Planescape, you know, every day can be completely different because of the portals to different places. That idea was translated, you know, in DC Heroes. I had always gave the players some JLA transporter tubes. You know, like every team I ever ran in DC Heroes were housed in the satellite, the JLA satellite, which was abandoned.
Oh, smart.
Always did that. So then you can go anywhere on Earth, use the tubes, quick travel, come back. Bam. My GURPS campaign is set in a town. We're always happy to return to it and to its NPCs when we take an extended trip outside. That always became like some games you can't do that, obviously, but most games you can find a way to do it. And I always kind of try as much as possible. If it fits the concept, I'll try to do that, because there's so much value in having regular NPCs, regular places, regular haunts, and something evolving in that place, you know. Like, the characters have an arc, but the world has an arc as well. It's much easier to track if you got, like, a single location. So that was my main takeaway from this, but I think it also has a lot to teach about characters' point of view and how to implement it in role-playing, but also in the rules in this case, you know. So the fact that these philosophies rule the minds of the characters, it's like, how many characters in any given game can really be said to have a philosophy of life that they are pushing? This makes players think about that and then maybe bring it into other games where, okay, now my character has beliefs and values and personal rules that they bring into it, you know, that are more than just a collection of quirks. I like that Planescape is pushing that idea.
Yeah, I have to agree with you that just to piggyback on what you were saying before, I think Sigil really, or Sigil, see, I'm doing it. I think Sigil.
You kept switching back and forth during the show, so I think the 50% are going to be happy.
I don't alienate anyone, so I'm going to say that. No, I said it your way. It did show me the value of making a city into a breathing character of its own rather than just a collection of locations. It was a place that very easily felt like a real place, much more so than even Waterdeep did, which was pretty good at it. But still, Waterdeep just felt like that. Mostly it felt like the inn that they lived in was where they thought, rather than this huge, weird city that we live in.
That was Planescape. I want to thank my guest, Jonathan Schaefer-Hames, for sharing his passion for the setting. Jonathan, tell the folks where they can find your other projects.
You can find my wife and I by pointing your podcatchers at MWC Podcasts. That stands for Married with Comics, or Married Watching Cartoons ostensibly, but also can stand for all sorts of things or nothing at all. Like right now, when basically all we're doing is speaking of D&D, it's myself and Clinton Robinson and John M. Wilson and Lane from Batman Books of Dark Knight and Prose are reading through the Dragonlance Chronicles and kind of really deconstructing them. The plan is to do all three of the Chronicles, but man, a lot of this book is not aging well, so we don't know how long we're going to go through it. But this is to prepare us for the fact that we all then go and play in a Dragonlance campaign later that day.
Okay.
That's loads of its own fun.
Dragonlance Book Club.
Yep. You can find it there. Otherwise, Maggie and I are over on Longbox Crusade Network doing Transformers Chronicles with Patton Delvin. You can find me on Twitter at MWC_podcast, or find Maggie at Maggie and the Rain.
All right. A portal just opened. Off you go.
Oh, this damn bottle cap.
And I'll be back after the break with Game Master advice and your feedback on our previous episode. Thanks again.
Hi, John.
Hi, Maggie.
I'm still wrapping my brain around the fact that we're married.
Me too, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Aw.
Oh, hey, I was looking at these old comics and I noticed that there's
That thought. Why don't we talk about it on our podcast?
We have a podcast?
It seems like the logical next step. We get married, we change our names, we combine our comic collections, we start a podcast about comic books.
Well, I can't fault your logic, but there are plenty of podcasts out there already. Do you really think we'll have anything new and interesting to say?
Oh, I think we'll manage.
So join us at the Married with Comics podcast. We're two newlyweds with a love for comics, intelligently, critically, and thoughtfully discuss comic books.
Also listen as we goof around, make jokes, and make fun of John for mispronouncing names.
I do that a lot. The Married with Comics podcast. Available directly on our site at marriedwcomics.libsyn.com, on iTunes, and wherever good podcasts are found.
We've got everything you need.
If I were Dungeon Master, I'd have it made.
What an interesting proposition. Very well, I shall give you all my power to use as you will.
With any long-running, open-ended role-playing campaign, I like to provide immersive elements to the players. We've talked about this before, usually in the form of handouts or websites or handouts available on websites. For example, for that old AD&D Planescape campaign, I found and adapted a series of newsletters published in Sigil, the City of Doors. An issue would become available once per adventure, every one or two sessions, and would include articles, gossip, and personal ads that could then be integrated into the character's story. Such a publication, and for more modern campaigns, a fake website will work just as well, has several uses. First, creating a more immersive campaign world that feels richer because it is larger than the PC's own experience. Second, it teaches the players about the world, its particular lexicon, its history, culture, and so on. Third, it seeds upcoming events that they will get involved in. And fourth, it seeds possible events they might want to get involved in. And fifth, ultimately, it creates excitement by having the character's own exploits referenced in an article. And possibly there's a sixth use, allowing the players themselves to use the news service in-game to transmit information, influence opinion, or fill their needs. For an open-ended campaign, number 4, seeding possible events, is, I think, the most important. Here you can put all sorts of ideas you've had and would be willing to expand on, but you're letting your players actively choose to pursue them. It was your idea all along, but now they've got skin in the game. On a narrative level, and you know how much of a narrativist I am, it gives the characters more agency as opposed to having things happen to them or, as in computer game RPGs, requiring a third party to consistently give them things to do. Number three, seeding upcoming events, is just as useful, of course, but used to create a sense of foreboding, tension, or inevitability. Here you should build up your upcoming event over several releases, issues or site updates, a developing story that eventually comes to a head. Mocking up a newsletter is a bit of hard work, which is why I adapted mine, in Planescape's case, from one found online. So thank you again, Mimir.net. It's a great resource for this particular campaign world, but a website or a Facebook group even can serve just as well and be a whole lot more practical. These platforms can even let your players get in on the game. For example, in my Dream Park campaign, players took on the roles of Maverick LARPers who themselves took on roles in holodeck-type adventures for a larger public. Well, the website kept their standings up to date, showed all the options open to them, and advertised upcoming events. But we also had a dedicated mailing list. It was the early 2000s, folks. But a mailing list where players would share their favorite moments. And also, in character, trash talking, fake eBay auctions of props used in the game, and so-called reviews, quote-unquote, of their performances according to the in-world media. It all depends on the world you're trying to build. A superhero world might have a website of who's who entries for heroes and villains, and upcoming villains, and issue synopses of the character's own comic. A modern supernatural game might have an encrypted website filled with secret files, with rumors and arcane information, accessible via smartphone during the game. Is the right solution somehow in there? There are many possibilities. And for adult gaming groups that don't get together very often, it may be the perfect idea to keep participants interested and fill those long gaming gaps with in-world activity. Comments from our previous episode of Let's Roll, which was about GURPS Mecha with my guests Put and Beb as usual. This was part of the Shift World campaign. The advice column was about dice rolling. Let me just read the star comment here. It's from Brian Linton. It says, throughout my childhood and teenage years, I was a big fan of Giant Mecha, Robotech, Voltron, Gundam, Evangelion, Escaflowne, and even Battletech, to list a few. So I was feeling the nostalgia as I listened to this episode. It sounds like you guys were firing on all cylinders at this point in the campaign. I particularly enjoyed hearing about the creative ways in which players were incorporating elements from earlier characters into their most recent versions and their mecha. Also, I'm glad to hear that you were able to wrap up the Shift World campaign, which that happened fairly recently. It sounds like everyone appreciated the closure. Finally, I enjoyed your advice about dice rolling. There's something visceral about rolling dice, and a well-timed dice roll is an easy way to interject some tension into the game. As an aside, I think a failed dice roll has the potential to be more fun than a successful one. Responding to a failure, assuming it didn't result in a total party kill, can encourage creativity in the players and lead to some great roleplay moments. Thanks for another incredible episode. Yeah, Brian, I think we just had that happen. Right now we're playing Torg Eternity and we're sort of playing it as a sequel to Shift World. We'll get to talk about that someday, I'm sure. And in a one-shot that was supposed to be horror, kind of a Resident Evil type scenario, where the characters were certainly disposable. Our good friend Marty was playing in the game as one of the Lonely Hearts who just got married. Congratulations, Marty. He had like a streak of bad rolls where he kept, in Torg, rolling a one is a mishap, and he kept rolling mishaps on a d20. What are the chances? And so he was responsible for a lot of bad luck throughout. And yes, he died. Kind of everybody did. It was sort of that kind of scenario. Okay, well, the Fire and Water Podcast Network has a Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcasts. If you like this content, want more like it, think about leaving a one-time or a monthly donation. Let me also remind you that you too can leave comments at fireandwaterpodcast.com, on the Fire and Water Facebook page, and on Twitter, where we are FW Podcasts. So until the next episode, let's roll.
magical construct designed to provide information. I am yours to command. Speak to me, and I will tell you all I